This audio file comes from the Libri Ideas Library at www.libri-ideas-library.org. The library contains over 1,000 lectures and discussions which explore questions about the reality and relevance of Christianity. We ask you to respect the copyright for this audio file, which belongs to Libri Fellowship. The file is for personal use to share with friends, family and colleagues, but please do not publish the material in any format or post it on a website without seeking permission from Libri Fellowship. Please note that views expressed in the lecture and discussion time do not necessarily represent the views of Libri Fellowship.
Voila. So yeah, majestic mountains all around. This machine is taking us up all kinds of runs, from simple to really complex and difficult. And I was sitting on this chairlift with these teenage girls beside me, two or three of them, about 13 years old. And they were talking about how their parents brought them every year to this place and how boring it was. How can that be? Yeah. Well, as far as we can tell, there is no other culture in history that has complained of boredom as much as we have. So if boredom used to be a little gray cloud on the horizon of Western culture, now it's come to dominate the whole sky. So it used to be here and there in a normal amount, but now it's at the center. It's a constant companion we're constantly trying to get rid of. This is the situation. The late professor of French, Reinhard Kuhn, said this: in the 20th century, ennui, which is the French word for boredom, it's not one theme among others, it's the dominant theme, a modern plague. Professor of English, Patricia Spax at the University of Virginia, wrote this in her book: boredom, it's become a metaphor for the postmodern condition. She would agree. The sociologist Orrin Edgar Clapp wrote this: a strange cloud hangs over modern life. At first, it was not noticed. Now it's thicker than ever. It embarrasses claims that the quality of life is getting better. It's thickest in cities where there are the most varieties, pleasure, and opportunities. Like smog, it spreads to all sorts of places it's not supposed to be. The most common name for this cloud is boredom. So, yeah, strangely, no other culture has complained of boredom as much as ours. And paradoxically, no other culture has been as entertained as we have at the same time. So, yeah, surely entertainment's been around as long as humans have been around. So music, storytelling, dancing, they've got a long history. All kinds of entertainment options do, but now we've got all kinds of options no one used to have in the last 100 years. Think of all the multimedia we have. Of course, you've got Facebook and YouTube and Snapchat and Pinterest. Not just to communicate with, but people go here more and more just to be entertained by these apps. So thousands of apps we can be entertained by. We've got thousands of video games we can choose from. Thousands of television shows. 100,000 different kinds of movies we could watch. Millions of songs we could listen to. And we could listen to them and come and tap into them in an instant. Anytime, any place, anywhere. So we've always had entertainment, but now we have the entertainment industry right in the palm of our hands. So, but wait, yeah, how can we be so bored and so entertained at the same time? Isn't a lot of modern entertainment meant to relieve us of our boredom? Here's an ad some years ago for the video game Grand Theft Auto. Bigger, bolder, faster, twisted, more weird. Remove all the boredom. Heighten all the action. That's the implicit promise, I think, in a lot of entertainment that's put our way. And if that's the promise, and with all this boredom still present deep down, it doesn't seem to be working for some reason. Why is that? And that's a question to live with for a while, to not just answer superficially, but give some thought to. As the title of Richard Winter's book puts it, we're still bored in a culture of entertainment. Richard Winter's a psychiatrist. He worked at English Labrie for a time. He is a professor emeritus at Covenant Theological Seminary in St. Louis. And of the books I've read on boredom, his has the most breadth. It's the most insightful, the most helpful, the one I've come across. Now, he wrote it in 2002, so my question recently was, I wonder if it's still up to date with the research with culture. And so I read a few other books recently just to see if that's the case. So I read this one here, Boredom, A Lively History, by Peter Toohey. I think that's how you say his name. He's from Australia. Professor of classics, though, at the University of Calgary, Canada. And he said he's long been bemused by boredom. He wrote this in 2011, and he interacts a lot with literature and visual art. And he dabbles in some psychology and evolutionary theory, neuroscience. It's actually a really fun read. He's a good writer. Another one I read, The Upside of Downtime, Why Boredom is Good. She's a professor of psychology at the University of Central Lancashire. And she's had her own private clinic as well. But she's read numerous books, hundreds and hundreds of articles on boredom. And her book was written in 2016. Not as well written, but a lot more researched. And after these two books, it became apparent, you know what, Richard Winter, he is still on point. His research is not out of date, and if anything, it's more true than it was back when he wrote it in 2002. Now, the only maybe difference is people now in 2018 go to their phones way more to relieve their boredom than they did back in 2002. So, most of the good content I'm going to be telling you tonight comes from this book. So I highly recommend it. If you want to deal more into this, if some of the things I'm saying interest you, this will go into more depth. This will give you a lot more background to what I'm talking about. So when it comes to boredom, I think our typical knee-jerk response to this unpleasant feeling is, quick, how can I get rid of it? As fast as I can. What can I do? What can I watch? What can I listen to? What can I scan on my phone? What can I eat? What can I drink? What can I smoke to get rid of it? I think that's, for most people, their first reaction to this emotion, this state of mind. So my hope for tonight is that it would help you to pause, to say, wait, this feeling's not going to kill me. And to pause long enough to ask some other questions about this emotion. What is it? What does it mean? Why is it there? So questions that go beyond the superficial quick fixes, but hopefully questions that broaden our understanding and our lives, that get down to the root causes of this complex emotion. And that hopefully help us to recover something of that childlike wonder that maybe we lost somewhere along the way. First, what is boredom? So if you could describe this emotion with another word or in a sentence or two, how would you do it?
Misunderstanding of peace.
I haven't thought about that. Misunderstanding of peace. Anyone else?
Got nothing good to sink my attention into.
Yes. attention, yes. Nothing interesting. Exactly. Anyone else?
Similar, disengaged.
Disengaged, yes. I think that's key. Very much. Anyone else?
Lazy.
Lazy?
Well, I'm too... Yeah, I was just reading an article on this, and it was like, I'm too lazy to do the things that really excite me, so I'm just going to watch TV.
Yeah, it's definitely linked. You're right. Well, I always like to go to the dictionary, because the dictionary at least lets you know how everybody else is using the word. So, according to Merriam-Webster, it's the state of being weary and restless through lack of interest. There's that word, interest. So that's what most people mean by it. That's at least what I mean by it. But, you know, a dictionary definition only goes so far. Let's go a little deeper. So on the low end, boring will underwhelm us, as they say. Will maybe cause us to say, meh, and walk away. On the high end, boredom might cause us to say, I'm bored out of my mind. It might make us feel a sense of disgust. So Iggy Pop has a line, I'm sick. I'm sick of all my kicks. That's on the high end of boredom. That's when you're going nuts. And there's different kind of words for boredom. Maybe you've heard of the word ennui I mentioned earlier. This is the French word, but has a sense to annoy, to frustrate. You're not getting out of life what you want. This is a frustrated boredom. Or acedia is another word which gets linked with it. It has more of a sense of being apathetic and slothful. Has a long spiritual history.
Say that word again, please.
Acedia. So A-C-E-D-I-A. And actually, Kathleen Norris has a great book on this that I'm not going to be getting into, but that could take us down another track. But here's some other synonyms. So you got monotonous, repetitious, uninteresting, flat, stale, drab or dull, lifeless. So it's that frustrating emotion, that state of mind when you feel there's nothing interesting around you, nothing interesting to do. And that lack of interest makes it really hard to focus and concentrate on what's going on. And so it's associated with sleep. I bored myself to sleep, Iggy Pop said. And frustration. I'm bored to tears. I'm bored to death. It can be really strong. And there's a sense of being disconnected and isolated from what's going on or the people around you, which gives us this really unpleasant relationship to our space and to time. So when it comes to space, we feel trapped. We maybe are trapped. So like you're in a lecture and you can't go anywhere for 2 hours. And time is our enemy. We need to kill time somehow, some way. And usually we try to do that through some kind of escape. That's how we try to kill time. Either physically by just getting up and going somewhere, or chemically changing our bodies through drugs or alcohol. Or mental, just imaginative. You just start daydreaming. You just go somewhere else in your brain and nobody knows, but you're somewhere else. Now, some creative people, they find a way to engage the situation, to find some way, somehow, to connect with the person they're with, the situation. But that's not most people, I think. Most people are looking for the escape, not a way to engage. Now, an image that I think summarizes a lot of this for me, as I've read different descriptions of boredom, is solitary confinement. This isn't actually a cell for solitary confinement. And this is, when someone is isolated, they're disconnected from normal life, from friendship, from companionship. They're cut off from anything that might be interesting. And They're isolated. They're understimulated. They've got nothing to do in here. So spatially, again, they're trapped, like it feels when you're bored. And time, again, is your enemy. How am I going to kill time until I get out? And so that little window there, that's the symbol of hope, escape. And until that happens, they've got to figure out a way how to, they can't physically escape, but somehow mentally they've got to get out of this cell. So people will sleep their way through it as much as possible. So in your sleep, you're in somewhere else, La La Land. Or some people, I've heard this one guy, he imagined himself traveling around the world just to make it, because he was in there for years. And it was the only way he was going to keep his mind. But I think it shows how unpleasant this emotion is for us. It's used as a form of punishment. This boring cell is used to punish people who've done something, according to the people who are putting them there, wrong. But I think, yeah, it also illustrates just what we're feeling when we're bored. So we feel this to some degree. We feel this solitary confinement to some degree when we're bored. Now, what I found interesting when I was looking at different paintings that depicted boredom, they looked an awful lot like solitary confinement. Not exactly like this, but the sense. So here's a painting. This is called Boredom. It's an oil painting from 1893 by Gaston de la Touche. Notice she's all alone. Nothing seems interesting to her. Nothing to do. Even though, interestingly, in this one, she's surrounded by a beautiful room. She even has entertainment. She's got this little, look at that, I got a little beamer here. A book on the table, one of the forms of entertainment at the time. But it's not catching her attention. So you don't have to be in prison to experience solitary confinement. That's interesting. So if this was painted today, maybe she would have a phone on the table. Maybe she'd have a stereo system behind her, an Xbox, a big 60-inch flat screen TV. And yet still bored. Why? This next one is called A Bloomsbury Family, painted by William Orpin in 1907. These were all famous people at the time, or eventually became. The father here is William Nicholson. He was an artist of multiple mediums. His wife was the painter Mabel Pride. One child married poet Robert Graves. Another one died in the Great War, but another one became a well-known abstract artist, another an architect. But with all this creativity in the family, man, they sure look like a boring bunch. They sure look bored. The room is stiff. Another recipe for boredom. And there's no life or activity going on. They're all together, but as Sherry Turkle puts it, they're all alone together. There's no relating to each other here. They're isolated, even though in their same room, and they're stuck. Maybe it was just they felt like this when the painting was going on, because you'd have to sit there for hours, not like a photograph. But they're trapped in this dark and dreadful room. I think it was painted intentionally like that. I think this is how a lot of people feel, though, normally, in their families, sometimes in their churches. It was really sad to hear. I was reading the Peter Tui book on boredom, and the first thing he lists as one of the most boring things for him was an Easter service. It's like, that is a shame. One of the most incredible things in the history of the world. And it bored him more than anything else. Well, one more painting. This one is called Ennui, again, the French word for boredom, by Walter Sickert. Notice again, they're together, but they're alone together. There's no life between this couple here. And they got nothing to do. They're trapped in this room, this house probably. Virginia Woolf wrote about this painting, "The accumulated weariness of innumerable days has discharged its burden on them." Oof. And the only escape, again, for this man is what he's smoking and this glass of booze on the table. And for the lady, it's these paintings. This one looks a little risque. Maybe she's having some sexual fantasies. Who knows? But these, again, are the more popular ways people escape their boredom. Drugs or sex, even if it's just imagined sex. Pornography being certainly one of those. Other ways people escape their boredom, from good to bad. It's not necessarily always bad ways people try to escape boredom, but they range from healthy to helpful to harmless to harmful to even evil ways people try to do this. So people just eat. Sometimes people, we just try to exercise. We look maybe for a creative challenge, a task to do to relieve it. Maybe try something risky. Maybe come to Legree. Maybe break a rule. Maybe break the law. Maybe get in a fight. Maybe kill somebody. There's been people who, when they've asked why they did a murder, they're like, I was bored. And in fact, Richard Winter mentions the KKK, because the KKK got started because a bunch of young men were bored with nothing to do. And a lot of vandalism happens that way, where some people prefer to go and do a good deed. Be a better way to do it, obviously. But more and more of us just pick up our phone and try to pass the time away when we feel it coming on. So again, these are always an escape. They can be good, they can be bad. But what if boredom is telling us something important? And we just keep trying to silence it as soon as we feel it. What if that's the case? So if you had a sharp pain in your chest, just slightly to the left, yeah, you wouldn't want that pain forever. You'd want to get rid of it. But more than that, you'd probably want to know, is it my heart? Is it something else I need to pay attention to? Pain, yeah, can be unpleasant, but it's usually telling us something important we need to pay attention to. What if boredom is doing something similar? That's what I would like you to remember, if anything. What if we don't give it enough credit? What if it's telling us something's wrong? What if it's telling us something important about us, about our environment, about our spirituality, even, our time in history? And that's something we might need to give some thought to, some reflection. We might need some help with this question. We might need to live with it for a little while, do some work. Because boredom has numerous causes, not just one. It's not just a boring circumstance that causes boredom. Boredom has many reasons behind it, many causes. So there is circumstantial boredom causes. There are personal, relational causes to boredom. There are historical, cultural causes. There are theological and spiritual causes to boredom. So it would be helpful to determine which one is causing this feeling right now, or which ones. It might not just be one going on. So we can start with simple, temporary boredom based on circumstances. So this is caused, yeah, simply by boring circumstances. You work on an assembly line and you're bored. That makes sense. It's a boring job. And unfortunately, the Industrial Revolution created a lot of assembly line-ish type jobs. They've taken a lot of the personal touch out of it, the creativity that we could have added, craftsmanship. This is thanks to the Industrial Revolution, which gave us efficient jobs, but many times the price we paid is that they're boring jobs because they're so efficient and they've got nothing else going on. Or imagine a lecture where the person speaking just keeps repeating the same point over and over again, monotone voice, never connects it to real life. That would be boring. Hopefully I'm not doing that. Or think of Andy Warhol's film Sleep, which was 5 hours and 20 minutes of his friend just sleeping. 9 people came to the premiere, and 2 people left after the first hour. Understandably. Understimulated. But overstimulation can also be a problem to boredom. It can cause boredom. So if I gave you too much information tonight, I hope I don't, but I might, that can cause you to disconnect and get bored and frustrated. So that could be the other end. But this is all temporary boredom, because you get out of the situation and boom, the boredom's gone. It's temporary. It's simple in that way. In the meantime, you doodle during the lecture. Or if you're at a monotonous job, you find something creative to do while you're doing it. Maybe you listen to music. More and more of us go to our phone, which is why a lot of businesses now have a little basket outside the meeting room. So you put your phone in there, because they know under the table people are doing this, pretending they're listening, but not. Fubbing, I think is the word. So, this is temporary, simple, circumstantial. It's more objective reasons out there, but there is more personal reasons, more subjective reasons. So we could call this subjective boredom, based on personal characteristics of the person. Before we go further, we're about halfway. How is the boredom level? You guys okay? Surviving? Anything not clear? We're going to have questions at the end, but anything clear, unclear, confusing? So far, so good? Okay. So, personal. This has to do with personal characteristics, memories we might have, choices we make. These can be all things that make us more prone to boredom. We're not maybe used to hearing about. So, for example, people with ADD, ADHD, people who are extroverts, they are all more prone to be bored, to struggle with boredom. So practicing patience, where you have to learn how to tolerate boredom, say in a conversation with someone, is a lot harder, a lot more necessary for us with these kinds of personalities. Because, yes, if we want to live deeply and broadly, if we want to be creative, if we want to love people, if we want to love God, we have to know how to endure boredom, at least temporarily. That's necessary for all those things, to some degree. Here's something else to keep in mind. People who have been abused, or people who are emotionally wounded, will struggle with boredom a lot more than the rest of us. Sometimes they'll struggle with chronic boredom, long-term boredom, where it feels like there's never anything interesting to do. And I think this is where we need humility and compassion. So just because we don't struggle with boredom that much, we should never look down on someone who does. We don't have their genetic makeup. We don't have their upbringing. We don't have their memories, their environment. So we just need to be careful there and be compassionate. That being said, these aren't the only reasons for boredom. There are others. So our own choices can cause boredom. The way we choose to live, patterns. So people who are impatient will struggle with boredom more. As we mentioned, I think earlier, or lazy. People who are procrastinators. People who are self-centered, who it's just about me, myself, and I. And of course, when it is just about me, myself, and I, that does get pretty old, pretty fast. And so no wonder when maybe we're bored because we've become boring. And that's the solution there isn't something entertaining. The solution there is wake up and love your neighbor and your God. Well, there's other boredom, what's been called existential boredom. This is when there's a lack, at least a sense, of a lack of purpose or meaning. This is a big cause of boredom. So this was me in high school. I did not see the purpose of what I was learning. I didn't see how it connected to life. That didn't interest me. I didn't do well. That was probably more my fault than my teacher's fault, but I didn't engage because I didn't see the connection. I didn't see the purpose. But yeah, there are activities that are boring activities, but we endure them for a greater purpose. So, for example, if you're a musician, you learn to play scales, you learn to play a piece of music over and over again. It's tedious. But you do it for the joy of being able to play later, either for yourself or for others, when it's all worth it. Or there's things in community life that are mundane, repetitive, like washing dishes, hauling wood, doing laundry. But, of course, we're always thinking inside, but this is for the community, so we do it with joy, right? But I think when we have this expectation that everything should wow us all the time. And I think that's something of what the entertainment industry trains us to do, to expect that, because we can get kind of wowed at the press of a button. And that's really disastrous for relationships. That's really disastrous for your relationship with God. When we come to each other and we come to God with online expectations, it's not going to end well. But something we struggle with in our age, maybe more than in any other age in the history of the world, is a lack of meaning and purpose, direction. So again, Patricia Spax, who we mentioned earlier, I'm not sure if she's a Christian, but she, in her studies, has seen with the decline of Christianity in a belief of a transcendent creator, that's gone directly parallel with the rise of a sense of meaninglessness and purposelessness. And I think someone who's done some recent work on this is Charles Taylor in A Secular Age. It's a big book, 900 pages. There's a 200 summary by Jamie Smith. I recommend if you don't want to spend all that time. But he traces this as well over the last 500 years and how masses of people now live for something. This is new in the history of the world, where masses of people are living without any reference to anything or anyone transcendent. But this has come with side effects. There are side effects. The malaise of our time, as it's been called, the flatness of life. Painful, pervasive boredom. It's in the air. And this would make sense if Christianity is true. If we were made to live face to face, so to speak, with the source of life, the creator of all things, who the Bible calls consuming fire. If instead of this enormous bliss we live with God to our back, so to speak, then it would make sense that things are notably dull in life. The response to this boredom should be the fear of God. That is the art of living in awe of God. We'll come back to that later. So, why are we still bored in a culture of entertainment? Well, maybe one of the reasons, at least, is that modern entertainment isn't intended to get to these other root causes of boredom. And maybe because a lot of modern entertainment actually exasperates it, makes it worse, makes us impatient because we have that expectation of being wowed immediately. So we come to life like that and then get disappointed. So that we expect to be wowed with very little to no effort on my part. I feel this in conversation sometimes. Sometimes someone's looking at me, but they're not really looking at me. They're looking at me like I'm a screen on a computer or on their phone. And their eyes are darting around looking for maybe something a little more interesting than me, to catch their attention, ready to swipe me away at a moment's notice, unless I wow them with something. And I want to yell and say, I'm not a screen to entertain you. I'm a person. But then I think, I do that too. Because our technologies don't just do things for us, they do things to us. They train us to relate to our surroundings, to the people around us, and to God in certain ways, and sometimes not helpful ways. It's worth paying attention to. I think, though, don't get me wrong, there is a place for occasional escape even, and distraction through entertainment. That can be a gift. It can be enjoyable. It can be a way to Sabbath. It can be a way to come back to normal life with even more fullness and an ability to live. But when distraction and escape become a way of life, yeah, then we have a problem. Then we're missing the point. And most likely we get addicted to something and our life has become very small and boring. So, who will rescue us when all the wonder has leaked out? That's a slight rewording of Eugene Peterson in his book, Christ Plays in 10,000 Places. And there he points us to artists, poets, architects, musicians, as people who can help rescue us. We read a poem this morning by Mary Oliver. These are some of the words from the poem. My work is loving the world, which is mostly standing still and learning to be astonished. I love that, learning to be astonished. To be astonished doesn't just happen. You have to learn it. You have to practice it. You have to engage your surroundings, the people around you, God. You can't just be totally passive. And sometimes it means standing still with boredom for a time until the wonder is entered. That's important to know. But I find, too, just hanging out with people who are wonderstruck, like the childlike artists, that helps. It just kind of catches on. You just kind of get caught up in the way they look at the world. I think reading poetry is like that. You read poetry and you get caught up in their wonder of things. 2 weeks ago, Sarah mentioned the Hungarian positive psychologist Mihai Csikszentmihalyi. I realize there's a little E on the end there. He is the one who recognized, named the state called flow. This is his national bestseller book based on all his studies. It's the layman's version of his studies. But flow is pretty much the opposite of boredom, almost in every respect. And Richard Winter talks a bit about this in his book. So instead of having a hard time concentrating in flow, you are totally focused on what you're doing. There's nothing distracting you. You are in it. Instead of nothing to do, you are doing something and you're doing it well. You've developed skills, and the skills you've developed are perfectly matching the challenge at hand. You're in the zone. You're not disconnected. You are engaged. You're immersed in the activity or relationship. Interestingly, too, you might have confined yourself. You probably have confined yourself in some way, shape, or form. So if it's sports or a game, you've confined yourself to some rules. If you're working in a workshop, the workshop is your confinement. If you're working on a poem, it's the structure of that poem, the space on that page. And it never feels like you're trapped, though. It feels like you're free. You're not trying to escape. You don't want to go anywhere else. And when it comes to time, time is no longer the enemy. You've lost all track of time. Time is somewhere else. 2 hours go by and you don't even realize it. You're in the groove. You're loving it. Here's a couple of descriptions from Mihai, from his book. It's what the sailor holding a tight course feels when the wind whips through her hair when the boat lunges through the waves like a colt, sails, hull, wind, and sea humming a harmony that vibrates in the sailor's veins. It's what a painter feels when the colors on the canvas begin to set up a magnetic tension with each other and a new thing, a living form, takes shape in front of the astonished creator. He chose the word flow because when he asked people to describe this state, that's the most common word they used, or something like it. And his team of researchers that went all over the world to people all through all walks of life, thousands of different people. Originally, they went to artists. That was his first initial interest. But then he went to people from all kinds of careers and professions, vocations. And this is what he found, no matter what they were doing. These are something of his results. So, on the left here, you have the challenge. All right, so down here, there's no challenge at all. Up here, super complex, difficult. Down here, you have your abilities, your skills that you've developed to meet the challenge. Down here, you have none. Here, you've worked at them for years, maybe decades. And so, basically, the higher the challenge that you can meet with skills, and you need to meet it with the equal amount of skills or abilities, the greater the flow experience will be for people. So if you have a low challenge with low skills, the flow is way down here. It's not that great. But if you have a big challenge with abilities that you've developed and you can meet the challenge, the flow is just going up. And it can go up and up and up. Not that people necessarily do it for the flow feeling, but that's just the experience that happens to people. So I'll give you an example. Say the example of tennis, okay? You've got someone down here who doesn't know how to play tennis at all. They've got a machine that shoots the balls out. He presses a button. It shoots it over the net, but there's no one even over there. There's no challenge, no skill. This is going to get depressing really fast, right? Then you get this same guy here, and you put him in with Spain's Rafael. What's his last name?
Nadal.
Or Switzerland's Federer. You put him in with one of those guys, well, the challenge goes up, but man, this guy's got no skill, so he's just going to be anxious. He's going to be stressed out. No fun. For these guys, though, they're going to have the abilities way over here, but they have no challenge. So they're going to be confident, but they're going to be bored too. Then you get these guys playing each other, which they've done a lot. I guess they're rivals for years. But you got the high challenge, you got the high skill, you got the potential for a high flow, basically. It's not automatic. Both of them still have to be present to the game. They can't be doing it for the fans or for the money, but for the game itself. And they enter this flow state. So this is what Mihai discovered, that the best moments in life, in our lives, are not the passive, receptive, relaxing times. He's not saying those are bad. He's just saying they're not the best, from what he's heard from people. The best moments usually occur if a person's body or mind is stretched to its limits in a voluntary effort to accomplish something difficult and worthwhile. And this challenge can be anything. It can be a sport. It can be a creative artistic endeavor. It can be a job. It can be a scientific quest. It can be a philosophical or mathematical problem. It can be a relationship, a friendship, a marriage, a community of people you're relating to. But the task is to develop the skills, the abilities, or the character to meet that challenge. And I think it's important to know that to do that development means you're going to endure boredom. You're going to need to endure boredom for a time, at times, to some degree. But the end is anything but boredom. And then there are some people Mihai has noticed, he calls them atletic people. He says these are the people who can go into any situation, no matter how boring or uninteresting, and make it interesting. They figure out a way to either make a game of it, somehow to creatively engage the person or the situation or the activity. So they're never at the mercy of their circumstances. They never blame their circumstances. They just find a way to gauge creatively. He gave actually an illustration of these guys, these sailors, passing one time out in the ocean when there were no waves, nothing. And I guess that can be a really dangerous time for boredom because there's nothing to do. There's no wind. If there's no wind, no waves, they're just sitting there. And so this one sailor was passing by another sailor and noticed this guy's boat was full of trash everywhere. It looked like a disaster. And then the guy was out there cleaning stuff up at the same time. He's like, "What were you doing?" He was like, "Well, I was super bored, so I just threw all my trash everywhere and then got to work and cleaning my boat. Gave me a task." Kept him sane. But when Mihai describes these different activities, and when people experience this state, it sounded an awful lot like what the scriptures call having dominion. What others have called the cultural mandate. So if there's a meaningful engagement with the world is something we were meant and created to do, it sure would make sense that when we do it well with skills and abilities that we've developed, that we would experience something like flow. Maybe it's some kind of affirmation, not to be taken just by itself. It needs to be, you need to make sure it's not idolatrous and that it lines up with loving God and neighbor and caring for creation. But still, we should pay attention to that and maybe see, could this not be an affirmation in some way? And then what about the challenge of living face to face with God, so to speak? Is there any challenge greater than that? Higher than that? What are the kind of skills, abilities, or character we need to match that challenge? I think a lot. It's hard. It's difficult. It takes practice to relate to God. It takes tolerating boredom along the way. We need to expect we will experience boredom when we read our scriptures sometimes, when we attempt to pray, when we attempt to serve people. That's part of the journey. But if this is what we're doing, then yeah, there's nothing greater than that kind of flow. Not that we would and should necessarily do it for that feeling, but that is maybe God's gift to us, his yes to that journey. And I'm more and more convinced the Bible would call this kind of flow the fear of God. Again, in the Old Testament, the fear of God is the Old Testament term for true spirituality. It's the art of living in awe of God. It's a different kind of fear. It's not about trembling at something terrible, but trembling at God's beauty and goodness. It's learning to be astounded by his works and his words and his holy, numinous presence. That should cause us to tremble. Not because he's bad, but because he's so holy and good. But this spirituality is not for adults. Sorry. Adults are too stiff and serious. This is for children only. Because, among other things, they know how to be astounded. I think of little Lily Chestnut. You know, we see an empty basket on the ground and we think, "Oh man, who left that there?" Lily sees it and she starts screaming with delight, and suddenly she's running around it, dancing and singing, and suddenly you are too. You know, what just happened? It's because, yeah, to be childlike, that is the best of all, according to Novalis. This is the last painting we're going to see, called Jesus Among the Children. This was painted by Emil Nold. I don't know if I'm saying that correctly. But working with what Jesus said, when he said, unless you change and become like children, you will never enter the kingdom. And I love, notice how the light and darkness work in this painting. So on the left, and typically you read a painting from left to right, like you read a book. So you start on the left here, and this is dark. And what do you see? You see the grown-ups over here, and the men in particular. And they can't see, they're not in a position to see the face of Jesus. They're kind of boring. They're in the dark. Then you have the children over here, and they can see the face of Jesus, and they're in awe of him. They are lost in wonder, love, and praise. That's their way. And they're in the light. And I think you can notice it gets lighter as these adults get closer to the children. They start getting closer to the light. And then there's, I think, the only woman I can tell over there on the right. She's the only adult in there. It seems like she's just become one of them. She's right in the mix. It's interesting that's a woman. Well, what about us who feel like we're something like these guys over here? What about if we feel like them, like we feel like all the wonder has leaked out? What can we do to become more like these wonder-struck children on the right, more than what we've already said? Oh, would that I were as children are. Well, the good news is, when the wonder has leaked out, we can be born again into holy awe. You know, I used to avoid that term for a long time. Born again language was so tied up with a version of Christianity that reduced the Christian life to a fire insurance policy. And so it left a bad taste in my mouth. I didn't really want to explore the meaning of it that much, to my shame. But now that phrase is full of promise and hope. The Holy Spirit can enable us to be born again into a holy awe. That's what his work is. We can become amazed little children again, astounded at our new Father and our divine brother, as we live in the flow, the enormous bliss of the Holy Spirit. May it be so. That is what I have prepared, but now we have a time to discuss, clarify, go down avenues that we didn't maybe in the lecture. Hear back from you, some of your experience of boredom, what it's meant for you, what's been your journey with it, what have you found helpful in dealing with boredom? So now it's up to you where we take it. Mary Frances.
This is just a thought. So I've done some work on play. So there's all sorts of things firing in my brain. But I was thinking about when you have that chart up and the y-axis, which is challenge, and how boredom sat sort of in the lower quadrant in the middle, so kind of partially down the way ability-wise. So there's a sense, if you look at boredom, there's a sense where there is some level of ability, right? But there's really low challenge. And thinking about that in terms of kids, in terms of children, and the current trends toward helicopter parenting, an obsession with safety, an obsession with self-esteem. And so very often what happens then is kids aren't actually challenged. They're not actually required to face and to walk through challenges. So it's, you know, it's like, no, 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 you don't have to do that. And so, but I was struck by the place boredom is on that chart, because there's a sense of like, okay, maybe the ability level isn't super high, but like there is ability there. There is dominion there. There is, right? But when the challenge isn't there, and I feel like very often, like we're just in a place culturally where adults are so entertained to death and distracted and busy, and that's getting projected on children.
Yeah.
And so that challenge piece is being taken out from under them.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore that dominion piece is taken away too. And I think sometimes you can hear kids being like, well, I don't know how to do this. I can't do it. And it's like, no, the ability is very much there, but the opportunities are not there, and the force function is not there to have to move.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting, I think, I don't know if there's any studies being done on this, but I know there are a lot of studies being done on the influence of technology directly on children, so when children themselves are in front of screens or things like that. But I'm also just very curious, and I don't know how you can siphon this out and would be able to measure it, but the impact of children on, the impact of technology that adults are using, and then how that, does that make sense, and then how that plays over to kids. So not even the kids necessarily sitting in front of the screens themselves, but having their lives mediated by adults who are bored and grabbing at things. Anyway, it's just a lot of different pieces, but...
Yeah, I mean, well, I think children just imitate their parents for the most part. And Sherry Turkle's really good at looking at this, because she talks about how parents, you know, tell their kids, get off your phones, you know. And they're like, what are you doing? You're doing the same thing. I'm just copying you. You're on as much as I am, if not more. But yeah, I think also there, a lot of stuff maybe we do on our phone is in some ways safe. And like it's, but that's not very interesting in the long haul. That gets boring. And when you take out all elements of risk, and I think that's another big element in life, is the fear factor. As we think we can have a totally safe environment all the time without risk, and life involves risk, and we shouldn't. I mean, there's calculated risk. You want to be reckless, but you keep kids from all risk, it's going to have disastrous effects, I think, and for play too. I don't know if I'm answering or but or responding exactly. There's a lot going. Yeah.
There's a lot there.
Tom.
I'm not sure if that chart captures play. I mean, some of the highest skilled people. Skiers, skateboarders, surfers, computer programmers started hacking. They didn't have much ability. Or a child playing with paints. You don't have much ability, but you play.
Yeah.
And there's flow happening right then.
Yeah.
You know, maybe you can fit it in, but it just seems like this is, and it's not to say that you don't, that all of those pursuits don't take some discipline and hard work at some point. But there's an underlying sense of play early on for many experts in their field. And this chart might be interpreted to say you got to work hard to get your abilities before you get into the big flow area.
Yeah, and I've seen other charts where there's a flow channel and it goes all the way down here.
Okay.
But it's just, this is meant to help you see that it can get more intense.
Yeah, I wasn't suggesting charts all wrong.
No, that's a good point. I think it's probably hard to capture real emotional life in a chart. And so even this, I mean...
It wouldn't come off flat, you mean?
Yeah, and there's more to boredom and anxiety than what's going on with flow, I think. And Mihai can be a little too, well, idolatrous to flow. Like, the purpose of life is flow.
Right.
And, I think there's a place for when you're really intensely engaging in a challenge, but there's a time for just fun play where you're not, it's not too intense. There's a time and season for everything under the sun. And I don't think Mihai has a lot of that. He's like focused on, this is what your life should be all about. And which, yeah, he's thoroughly secular and
right.
it's maddening at times. His view of Christianity is terrible. I don't know what he was reading when he read about Christianity, but it wasn't the Bible, it seemed. But he still has really insightful things to say, I think, on what's happening with people when they're experiencing this intense enjoyment and how that relates to a variety of things. It's not just the artists. It's people who are involved in crafts and business and
right.
You name it. But, yeah, you're right. I would never want to downplay something like play or, you know, you're not experiencing flow because you're a little kid and you haven't developed your skills yet.
Sometimes that's where some of the biggest skills are developed.
Yeah.
I mean, I have business friends who are faced with a problem, so I need to play with it for a while. And the adults in the room said, we don't play. And the physicist friends say, I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
So the autolytic is the person who's able to find interest in things that are not interesting?
Yes.
Okay. So I was wondering if there's any autolytics here that could comment on your... Bible and prayer is just going to be boring sometime. Comment.
I don't know if I could claim to be an autolytic person. Yeah. I still experience too much boredom. But yes.
I'm not an autolytic. Hey, Joel, by the way.
Hey, Joel.
I guess I was just curious if you could just expand on that. Question, what do you mean by getting bored, lonely, praying, reading the Bible? I'm just curious about that. If you could just define that out more.
Yeah, I think, I don't know, I think every Christian has experienced that Bible reading where it just doesn't feel that lively, and it feels mm-hmm. like you're just kind of reading the same thing you've read before. We've all had the other times where you're reading and the scripture jumps off the page and like you feel this illumination that you've never read it, even though you've read it dozens of times, right? So I think it's Dave? Is it?
Yes.
So I think Dave was admitting that you're going to be bored sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in my life, in my Christian experience, that's true. I was just wondering if everyone's here going to agree with that, or if there's someone that's going to stand up and say, no, it's going to be interesting every time because of X, you know?
Try reading in groups. Bounce ideas off one another, so we get out.
Yeah, I agree with that, but unfortunately, I don't always have a group to read with. So
yeah,
like something that like Sarah was just saying in that one lecture about Kedra, like enjoying the process through that. So like, you know, the low points of like, oh, you're bored, but then you know this is going to have a bigger meaning. So like, just that learning to love the process through that, you know, through the times when you're. The Bible verse doesn't hop out at you or something, but like, there's always you're putting into a different perspective. Right when you feel that boredom come, then you shoot it right back to perspective, and like always
mm-hmm.
kind of stay positive on kind of anything you do. Like, and like that's how like I like the low boredom points because that's kind of where I feel like that's where you're improving most.
Mm.
And like then whenever you get to the that super high flow feeling, you can only be there because you know that you it's been such a journey. Like, you can't just pop up at the flow all of a sudden because, you know, some moment in time, it had to be through that process that you were able to experience that the most.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds great.
I don't know if this makes sense, but is there something like that dark night in the soul that has a positive energy to it that where if you got bored enough with boredom,
say that last part again. If you got bored enough with boredom.
If you got bored enough with boredom, in other words, it's sort of like giving up. You know, it's just, but there's a capacity, there's a potential that happens when you give up.
Mm.
Space available for.
Like a surrender kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know.
Well, I wonder too. I mean, I don't know if. I don't have the assumption anymore that life should be the same emotion always, but that there's a season for everything. and what is the season I'm in, whether it's scripture reading or a relationship, and what should I be doing with this season? How should I be being faithful in this? And sometimes if it's a boring season, well, that's what I've been given for some reason. I might not know why. Maybe it's to surrender. Surely it's to trust and to continue to be faithful, even when it's not exciting. To prove my love, in a sense. Not like I need to prove my love, but I think in a relationship it's like that with a friend or a spouse. I mean, there's times when it maybe feels boring, but you're like, I love this person, even though I don't feel excited right now, but faithfulness is more important. And
there's a wonderful chapter in a letter, in Screwtape Letters, and C.S. Lewis's principle, I was just talking with a group of people this morning about it, the law of undulation. That the closest we ever come to constancy, Lewis says, is a series of peaks and troughs. And that God actually can accomplish a lot more sometimes during the troughs.
Yeah.
Because we don't depend on the feeling, but we still obey. And
yeah.
We still trust, and we still keep going. But that we shouldn't expect them to be on the peak all the time.
Yeah.
Because we're well, he says we're amphibious. We're spiritual, but we're material too.
Yeah.
And that's
the Psalms. I mean,
this law of undulation.
Yeah, I think the Psalms are an example of that.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Like taking you through all your kind of emotions. Yeah. I mean, the tough thing is I don't see people struggling with boredom in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I just don't know if it was as big an issue as it is today. And maybe we need other psalms, hymns written that help us through boredom in our prayer life and our scripture reading.
Because it may have looked a little different.
It may, yeah. I'm curious.
There's definitely some of the why and what's the meaninglessness and, why do you allow this to happen this way?
Doesn't
seem to be the way it should be.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of questions. I mean, David certainly is the best thing about him is he's just so that he brings all of it to God.
Yes, exactly.
And that seems to be the real key.
Mm-hmm. We got one, two. Adam.
Something early on in the lecture, it said people who have been abused are more prone to boredom.
Mm-hmm.
How does that happen, or why does that happen?
I don't know fully. It wasn't fully explained in the book. He just listed it. In my imagination, it's, you've been abused. You put up barriers. You start to disconnect yourself out of not trusting or whatever. And that's the recipe for boredom. When there's a barrier between you and other people and things, then that gets really boring. And but understandably why. I mean, it's understandable why people put up the barriers to protect. But that's at least, yeah, I don't know. Unless maybe somebody's more knowledgeable on that than I am, but I wish I had more to tell you. But I've seen that, I guess, in people, even though I don't fully understand it.
You also said online expectations will kill a relationship. What did you mean?
I mean, when you're online, you're used to having things happen instantly. At the push of a button, you swipe, you move, you're getting served immediately. If you come to people and God like that, it's not going to work very well. Yeah.
Okay.
It takes people take patience. And, I think being online a lot can cause us to be impatient. And short with people more than we would normally. I've noticed that if I'm on the computer too long, if I start to relate to my kids or something, I'm shorter or impatient. What am I? They're not a screen. But
how much do you think it's related to the fact that we don't have, I don't want to say monotonous, but like work that we need to do every day, like physical work that's kind of repetitive? I'm thinking baking bread, doing your laundry. all that kind of stuff, that our modern conveniences have taken that time away. And I'm not saying it's so much in the fact that that's gone, but one of the side effects of that is you have more time to contemplate things while you're getting the task done. Whereas now, even if you're at work, you're usually in front of a computer, and usually like 50 million things are happening at the same time, so you can't even really stop and think anymore.
Yeah.
So just the nature of just being a modern society, from my dishwasher to my microwave, and just even our appliances, not even the smartphone, like, has this just been on a trend to make people more bored since the people went around in, like, you know, the 50s and 40s and all of our modern appliances and everything like that? Like, are we just at the tail end of a huge summation of our boredom just getting bigger?
Yeah.
And bigger and too much, yeah.
It seems there's a lot of factors. Yeah, I mean, one of the things people pointed out is the increase in leisure time, that time we have to fill, because we had to work maybe more 200 years ago. But now, yeah, average work week might be, well, it depends on how many jobs you have, but it could be 30, 40 hours, and then you've got a lot of other hours to fill. What are you going to do? You've got time to kill. So that's one of the facts. And it does show that, like, there's things in culture that increase our boredom level and cause it to be a bigger problem. I don't know if I'm answering. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. That's talking about what you're talking about.
You, earlier in the talk, you likened boredom to a heart pain that is warning us of something more serious, you know, almost like it's an alarm clock type of thing. So if we liken it to an alarm clock, what is the boredom alarming us to do? Like, an alarm clock saying, get up and start your day. What is the boredom alarm clock telling us to do? Is it always a call to prayer? Is it a call to invest in people? Or is that just, you have to figure it out for yourself?
Yeah, well, that's partly why I said it could be one or it could be a number of things. And it's not straightforward. It's not always so obvious what the boredom is. It could just be your circumstance. You're in a boring circumstance. It could be you're super self-centered. It could be you're living with God to your back. You know, it could be all of those things at once. So it takes some discernment, which I think is another thing we're really lacking these days and hungry for. Mm-hmm. But we need to practice more discernment and come alongside people who have that discernment too and say, I'm feeling this and this is my life. What do you think? What's this pointing to?
Yeah.
And, because you need help with that. I don't know if it's something you can always do by yourself. And certainly to ask God, to say, God, show me what this means and what a good response. What's a wise response? Not just a quick fix,
right,
so that I can feel better, but I want to be better. I want to live better, more fully. So.
Good answer.
Yeah, it's very interesting to me. Skiing in the woods today, and wasn't very good. It was too crusty, but so it required a lot of attention. And that's why I had to stop every now and then. The enormity of just being out there in the quiet and the trees and the woods and just the whole, as you say, the awesomeness of God.
Mm.
I think it's enormous when you stop to think of it. Jeff and I were just talking on the way down. Just the thought of the whole nature of our faith and Christ and the cosmic sacrifice and the forgiveness that we have.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that I find, the reason I think I'm not bored is because I don't have a computer. I don't have a TV. I don't have a smartphone. And I have to do a lot of things to keep the house going. And so I think she's right. I mean, there's something rather remarkable, and some of the things that people complain about in boredom, I don't have, and knowing a little bit about technology makes me realize there's something that's going wrong with us as a culture. Matter of fact, there's no question about that. And
yeah.
A lot of it has to do with technology.
I remember I've only watched one reality TV show, and it was this one where they had all they had these families live as if they were pioneers. Did anyone see this? And did you see it? Yeah, well, it was great to follow the whole thing, and then to follow them when they came back to normal life. Because at first, especially the kids, they hated it. They're like, they were sneaking in their phones and alcohol, and then the kids ended up loving it. They learned how to just make games out of things outside and play with each other more, interact, and the dad really loved his work because he was outside, he was building things, and the mom hated it because there were no conveniences and she was in the kitchen all day. And so then they go back to modern life, and actually the wife loved going back. The dad hated it. He was like a successful businessman, but he felt like his job was super boring. And then the kids are there, and they have this picture of them playing video games, and they're like, how do you like being back? And they're like, we're so bored. Playing video games. And it was just interesting. Now, I think people can use technology wisely and well. I don't think the answer is necessarily throw all our computers away and everything electronic is evil and bad. But there's a wise way to live with these things and unwise ways. And like, there's a lot going on now. One, two.
I just think it's interesting how our culture says the opposite of boredom is to do more things. And they use busyness as the opposite of boredom when, in fact, the busiest people are the ones with the largest holes in their hearts, to speak. Mm-hmm. They're the ones that are most bored with their souls. And like you were saying, we have so many options for entertainment now, but it's like, then why are we still so bored? And even in deciding what to do with our boredom, it's just creating space for the fear of God to come into our lives more and to be more astonished. Which is why I think that even though if we like pray or read our Bibles and we don't feel that astonishment, we are still doing something with our time to allow that astonishment to be present in our lives. So it's interesting how in deciding what to do with our boredom, we like should focus on those activities that would enlarge our perspective to find more of the fear of God, to find that astonishment.
But yeah.
I like what you said about just like the busyness, because often, I mean, even as a kid, I was told, oh, you're bored, we'll go find something productive to do. But that productivity often was not enlarging my mind to have more fear of God. So.
Yeah. Yep. Right on. Yes.
just a comment and a plug for a book that talks about some of the how technology works to perpetuate boredom. Is a book by a guy named Andy Crouch called The Techwise Family. And he has, it was really eye-opening to me. And as a family, we're still trying to sort of incorporate some of his warnings about being so tech-savvy, or so tech-saturated. But he says that the technology and the entertainment culture is designed to keep us bored, and so that we sort of continue to consume, and advertisers keep watching, we keep watching, so put money in advertisers' pockets, it's this big system. But he describes it as if you sit and stare at your backyard in the winter. He's in Pennsylvania. He said, and it's covered in snow, and you just watch. And occasionally, if you're lucky, a cardinal will fly by. And the red of the cardinal will just be so striking. And the reason it's striking is because it's against this backdrop that you've just been staring at and taking in. And you said video games and commercials, these 30-second ads or 5-second ads before your YouTube video itself, everything you're watching online is just like the cardinal, the cardinal, the cardinal, the cardinal, the cardinal, over and over again. And it doesn't match your reality. So you've taken in this high level of like beautiful things, but reality doesn't actually like have the same proportion of cardinals. There's a lot more sort of boring or seemingly boring or mundane sort of snow-covered backyard. And he says it just creates this dissatisfaction.
Yeah.
With what you see, so then it pushes you right back on, or pulls you right back on, so that you keep watching and advertisers keep making money off of you and, you know, all these people that are... Anyway, so I thought that was, for me, that was quite a vivid image of
yes.
why I find myself pulled back to technology myself. I was like, oh, this is what it is. It's because my life doesn't have as many cardinals as this. You know, YouTube video or whatever it is I'm watching.
Yeah, words for me that maybe apply to that and what Elizabeth just said was a contrast between how much can I consume versus how can I savor this moment, this backyard, you know, because if it's just consuming, the entertainment industry is pretty good because there's lots to consume over and over. But if your goal is to learn how to slow down and savor, that's different. You're going to be like, oh man, the entertainment industry is too fast. I need to slow down. Cause you got to learn how to savor, I think. You don't have to learn so much how to consume. That just happens pretty passively. But,
Where's the book?
It's called The Tech Wise Family, Andy Crouch. It's a small book.
And even just plug in Ben's lecture on thankfulness. I find that's a really important practice in all of this. If I practice thankfulness with what's happening enough to slow down and actually be thankful and give thanks to God, that is part of engaging, that is not consuming. It is savoring and taking in more in a different way. We got one back there, and then up here. Let me hear. Yeah.
Maybe stating an obvious point, but it seems as though that this, you know, problem with boredom is really a function of loneliness, and technology allows us to be alone with ourselves, and we have smaller families these days in the West, and wealth helps us to afford really to live alone if we want to. And just recently, I think it was maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, in England, they appointed a minister of loneliness to deal with the problem because the impact it can have on one's health, even. So it seems like there's probably a connection between the two.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, again, a function of lots of different things, the technology and just overall wealth in the West, at least.
They used to, they call it Singles Day in China. It's like their Christmas up there. It's a February, but it's good for singles.
All right, 1, 2, 3. I think you're. Oh, yeah.
Sorry. Well, it occurs to me, I'm doing some reading and preparing to talk some about cultivating children's imaginations, and I've done a lot of work on this, and that's an ignored part of our makeup. That's a really important part of our makeup. That's, we expect everything to come at us.
Mm-hmm.
We don't cultivate our own imaginations, and that can be a real factor.
Yeah.
It's the difference between reading a book and having to bring to that, creating, getting the pictures and seeing the pictures and imagining the characters and all of that. And I think imaginative literature is a huge, hugely important thing. Not just seeing the movie.
Yeah.
Where all the
imaginative
stuff has already been done.
Yeah.
Because it's so much more passive.
Yep.
I think that can contribute to
I think yep. Michaela.
I'm thinking of people who are the least bored people that I know, who would fit into your book, that word. I think of people who ask very good questions, and who, one woman in particular, who her lack of fear in saying, I don't know, tell me more about that. But with people, but also with God.
Hmm.
And when she comes to scripture or prayer or things that she doesn't know, her refrain is always, tell me more.
Hmm.
And the deep curiosity, and it goes along with Lenny's thing of imagination. Like, your ability to be curious is a cure from boredom. And, I mean, growing up, I remember my mom always saying, boredom is a choice. Boredom is a choice to not be curious. And I just think of how often that's just not challenged anymore.
Yeah.
The lack of curiosity and the lack of people's ability to say, oh, tell me more, or I don't know that. Like, that's really interesting. Tell me more.
Mm-hmm.
But we're so easily, you know, fine with just Googling something and, like, that being the answer.
Yeah.
Asking other people what they think, or asking your neighbor instead of just, or the person next to you instead of just Googling.
So, it seems like there's an assumption, I don't know something,
yeah,
and there's something to find out. Where maybe boredom is like, I already know.
Yeah.
There's nothing to learn.
Yeah.
But with that person, it's... there's always, I mean, I think of that even with formal lunch or discussion meal questions. Mm-hmm. You know, at Libri, if you've been around for a few years, you start to hear some questions more than once, mm-hmm, maybe 50 times, you know. And I can't remember where I heard it from, but somebody said, yeah, it might be the same question, but it's never really the same question because it's always a different person with a different story. And they're asking it for different reasons, maybe. So pay attention to that. Pay attention to them. It's different. It's unique, even though it's the same question. So it's like, oh, wow, that really helped. It sounds like this friend of yours, they do that with everything. that's what we should do, probably. Tom?
And I'm going to put in a plug for technology.
All right.
I mean, first off, we've narrowed the definition of technology nowadays. I mean, a jet plane is technology. A musical instrument is technology.
Yeah.
And
a book
is technology.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's how you engage. Are you passive or are you active?
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with Jack Barzun? He was a historian. Mm-hmm. He wrote a history of the Western world.
Okay,
500 years. Mm-hmm. He waited until he was 90 years old because his thesis advisors, when he wanted to do it as a young man, the guy said, no, you need more experience.
he wrote
a massive piece. He died somewhere shortly after 2000, around there. But around 2000, he published this piece, you know, 500 Years of Western Civilization.
Yeah.
And at the time, I heard him on the radio, and he said, modern civilization, people are bored, they don't know what direction they're going in. He said, oh, but not the technologists. They are on fire, they know what they're doing, they have purpose in life. I'm not trying to say it's the same as God. Well, I think it's related to God's purpose. I mean, I have a physicist friend who said, I'm a physicist, I'm doing one of the first commandments is to subdue the earth, you know, understand,
yeah,
have dominion. So there's a whole, I mean, I do technology every day. I'm not bored with it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tool that I use, but it's not just passive, it's engagement. It's engagement, making a tool or using a tool well.
Mm-hmm.
And I just laugh as a mechanical engineer. I just laugh at the idea that technology is only electronics and screens.
Yeah.
You're
right. We don't distinguish enough when we say technology.
Yeah,
what do we mean?
Again,
what do we don't mean?
How
yeah.
do you engage? Are you a tool yeah. maker? Are you a tool user? Are you sort of a passive? I'm not sure what to call it.
Consumer. Yeah. But I mean, it's good. I would want to highlight that. Our technologies do stuff to us too.
So there's that. But if you heard
influence,
that online, it's like technology's bad. Why do we even have it?
That's why I wanted to say I'm not anti-technology. Or everything in this room would have to go.
I mean, the technology got here through people who were not bored and were very engaged.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I think. Did you have a? No. Okay. Did I see a hand over here? No.
Perhaps we've gone this long without mentioning drug use to fill the pain of boredom. That's, I guess, technology too, I guess, in a way. There's certainly a lot of different varieties of drugs to fill that pain.
Mm-hmm.
I've done a couple myself, alcohol, marijuana, some mushrooms. You just kind of fill that thing, and people you're around just... You know, it's something else to do. Screens is one thing, sure, but drug use is adds a whole other layer to that mix, and that's been there for a very long time, way before this rampant technology use. You know, before then, it was, drugs. You know, you got to kill that pain. Boredom was associated with pain.
I think it's still big. I mean, that's still a go-to for tons of,
yeah.
Thousands of people, yeah. I would say So yeah, I mean, I mentioned it, but yeah, we haven't talked about it, but it's an issue.
Yeah, just another comment about technology. I certainly agree with the gentleman about technology. The problem is, I think, if 90% of the people don't know how to use technology and it's doing bad things, including the children, and 10% of people seem to know what to do with it, does that make it just terrific?
No.
And, you know, to be sure, there's no return. There's no return. But I'm afraid we're headed, in my own opinion, we're headed for disaster.
Yeah.
In part because of technology. Significantly because of technology.
The atom bomb is technology, too. I mean, you know, the atom bomb is technology.
Yes. 9/11 is technology. So many things are technology. As a physician, I just read in the New England Journal the other day that there's a real crisis now because so many physicians are leaving practice. And the lead reason is because of electronic medical records. Yeah. Disaster.
What? Yeah. I don't get it. Why?
Because there are so many physicians that because of the use of electronic medical records find the labor and the work to do the job each day takes 3 or 4 extra hours.
All the energy saving.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, in many ways, these technologies are meant to be efficient, time saving, but then they end up taking up all your time. I'm realizing, though, is it? Okay. We still have time. This is only 9:30, right? Okay. Maybe a couple more questions.
Thinking about the tower sucking in the high and the skill. And then, within, technology, too. So, once you've experienced that ultimate, high and with the skill, and then if you don't, you're not practicing that skill all the time, and then, your skill level goes down, but you've always still got that super high expectation, and that kind of level goes down, but your skill can go down, but you're always, it's so much harder to meet that perfect flow whenever you're not constantly in that skill anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And then whenever you go to technology and then you see where those same people are at the same level and they're hitting the key point at the end, then that's it even more puts you in that boredom depression mode within that. And so this is you can't put the whole life on a chart thing, but how whatever, I guess you'd have to decrease the your expectation to a certain extent to have that focused happiness. You have to meet yourself where you're at a certain point, because it's kind of some of the stuff that I'm going through now is because I've done all these other things so much, all these super life experiences, all these high up stuff, whatever. It's just when you just go do the simplest thing, it doesn't please you. And then two, it's the goals and aspirations that you set for yourself in life. Whenever the play thing was mentioned, when you're a child, you have that play. Well, what's your expectation that you're bringing to that? Is whenever, I was 7, 8, 9 years old, playing sports, all my other friends, they were, having a happiness, playful, and in my mindset it was all I'm just trying to do the hardest I can be, trying to go to number one, in every kind of thing. So there wasn't no play, I never took done it like that. All the sports and stuff I've done were just all serious, there wasn't no play. So it's kind of what expectation you set on yourself too at that time to have that too. So it's kind of how what is your goal? It has a lot to do with boredom and how you look at it like that. Mm-hmm. And then too, I think that goes back to the curiosity that Nikki asked. When you've always got that that hunger, and it keeps the boredom away too, instead of having that.
Yeah.
But then it's a super drawback to that, because whenever you're not meeting that expectation, then you're even farther on the other side.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and again, and not to make, like, getting rid of boredom the ultimate goal.
Yeah.
But just as a sign, like, yeah, if you're experiencing boredom, well, yeah, maybe you're just not challenged enough. You need greater challenge. Find a new challenge. Yeah, Mary Frances, you're going to... No, go ahead, yeah.
I was just thinking about you said in your talk that the descriptions of flow reminded you a bit of dominion, mm-hmm. the idea of dominion in the Bible. And I just think of that as so much of the Christian faith is about God is inviting us to participate in what he's doing. And I think that we can have a passivity about like, oh, well, I have to do this, I have to do that. Like, God's sort of setting these things out that we just have to knock around in. But he's actually really inviting us to participate in his kingdom, in his work here, and in the world that is to come. And dominion is one of the first places that I think we see man's participation. It's like, no, you name him. And Adam really having a choice when he's naming, given the option to name the animals early on. And I was thinking about just all the things we've talked to. I mean, whatever it is, drugs or screen time or food or whatever that, so much of that is about, it's about checking out. It's about disconnecting. It's about actually not participating in reality.
Mm-hmm.
And I think of a critique sometimes of Christianity or just of religion is that it's like, oh, it's this like fake world that people are trying to live in where the Christianity, the Bible, is actually telling us the truest things about reality.
Mm-hmm.
It's very much about reality. And so I think when I think of boredom, I think of that checking out, the disconnection, the hands off of, and we want to be, you know, it's like, I'm not a puppet. I'm, you know, in our sort of Western world of individualism and self-reliance and reality is not out there. Reality is in the self, right? So we don't want to be sort of anyone's puppet, but yet at the same time, we are so often just abdicating the dominion and that God has given us to participate.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's just, when I just think of my own life and where are the times where I feel bored or where does that trip me up? And it's very much of like, I'm disconnecting. I'm not wanting to participate for whatever reason in what God has set before me. But that ultimately is what life with him is participation.
Yeah. Exactly. Any other comments, questions? Okay. We'll finish there. Thank you, everybody.